Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we'll talk about the potential Arizona impact of President-elect Trump's proposed tariffs on Mexico.
And why one writer says Sedona is still worth visiting, even if it is over-touristed.
But first, the four Republicans on the Arizona Corporation Commission have voted to have the agency's attorney investigate whether its fifth member and only Democrat violated state laws and the commission's code of ethics. The dispute centers, at least in part, on comments she made about the salary of the CorpCom's executive director. Wayne Shutsky from KJZZ's politics desk has been reporting on this and joins me now to talk about it. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So what did Anna Tovar do, according to the four Republicans on the CorpCom?
So the Corporation Commission voted to give the executive director, Doug Clark, a $20,000 bonus a few weeks ago. And she just, you know, kind of voiced her displeasure. She was the one dissenting vote on that. And she made some comments about she believed his salary was already quite high, that they've had some turnover with staff, those kind of things, that basically she didn't think he was deserving of this bonus. And they said, you know, that she was discussing items they discussed in an executive session, which is a private session that public bodies are allowed to have out of public view, and that violated the state's open meeting laws, which basically says that kind of stuff has to stay private.
What did they say that she said that in public that was said during executive session that she shouldn't have said publicly?
The allegations were a bit vague, but basically like details of Clark's salary, that type of thing, to which Tovar replied, you know, that like salaries of public employees are public information. Mm-hmm. You can records request that and find out what any of these employees are making. It's more specific details of the negotiations and that kind of thing that are kind of off limits to discuss in public. So she believed that everything she said in those public meetings was fair game.
So I hate to ask a cynical political question, but I'm going to anyway. She is the one Democrat on this commission. Her term will expire in a few weeks now. Any chance there's politics at play here?
Well, you don't have to say it because Commissioner Tovar, to me, called it a political witch hunt. And this was kind of surprising for me because, you know, even when disagreeing with her colleagues, which happened a lot, being the only Democrat on the commission this term, she was always pretty congenial, and same with them back to her. Like, it wasn't a lot of name-calling. It wasn't a lot of yelling. Some of the stuff we see down at the legislature sometimes, you know, they would disagree, but it didn't get super heated. So to hear her use a term like political witch hunt really kind of stuck out to me.
And she is somebody who has talked about the board, the commission's ethics code before, right? And now she is the subject of an investigation into it.
Yeah, she kind of brought up a while back that there's really no enforcement mechanism on this, or even if you find out and that someone did violate the ethics, what do we do about it? There really wasn't like a roadmap there for like next steps, what happens, all these kind of things. And she kind of pushed the commission trying to change that. And ultimately, it didn't get anywhere with the leadership at the commission.
So she called this a political witch hunt. What are the Republicans who voted to start this calling it? I assume not that.
No, and not a lot of public comments. But then when they did take the vote to direct their attorney to look into it, you know, Commissioner Kevin Thompson said, you know, that we always have to hold ourselves accountable to state laws. We all have to obey these things. And so this is an effort to do that. Chairman Jim O'Connor, who always has seemed to have a pretty good relationship with Tovar working on the commission, you know, expressed some sadness at having to take that vote. But again, there does seem to be some politics in play in the background beyond just trying to hold each other accountable.
So you alluded to this, but let's get into a little bit more. Why did Commissioner Tovar think that the executive director didn't deserve this additional money?
A lot of it had to do with, she pointed out, there's been a lot of staff turnover at the commission, a lot of just, you know, leadership positions and kind of higher up positions have changed over in recent years. And that's a little bit of a change. You know, the general counsel who was there for, I think she was their general counsel for 7 years, was there for over a decade, was fired a little while back and filed a discrimination lawsuit claiming that, you know, that firing wasn't above board. So a lot of kind of issues there. And she basically just said, you know, she voted to hire the guy. So it's not like she has a vendetta against him, but she just basically said, I don't think based on these things that giving him an extra $20,000 on top of his already high salary was prudent at this moment.
Well, and she said, I think I'm right about this, that she's not even putting all of these problems at the executive director's feet. She's not blaming him for all of it. She's just saying that given all of this stuff, maybe the person who's in charge here shouldn't be getting more money.
That's basically what she said. Yeah, yeah. That's a good summation of what she said. Yeah. I'm not going to say all of this is his fault, but $20,000 bonus amidst all of this, not a good look.
Yeah. So what happens next? There's a time deadline on this investigation?
Yeah. Chairman O'Connor directed general counsel to give him a report back on these allegations within 10 days. Now, I'm not exactly sure how the Thanksgiving holiday plays into that, but I'm imagining within the next week or so, we should get that report back from the general counsel for the commission.
And what are the possible options? Like, as we mentioned, Commissioner Tovar's term ends in January. Like, what are the possible outcomes here?
Well, it ends in January. And as I mentioned before, there's no real clear, you know, what outline of what they do next. So honestly, you know, I could see them voting to just say that this was bad behavior and that it isn't, or even a referral potentially to the attorney general if they believe that she violated the open meeting law. Now, the attorney general is a Democrat, Chris Mays, who is some see as an ally to Anna Tovar, and Anna Tovar actually complained that her fellow commissioners violate open meeting law to the attorney general, and Chris Mays found that they did. So whether they'll take that next step, who knows, but that's a possibility if they believe state law has been violated.
And you mentioned that Commissioner Tovar called this a political witch hunt. Any sense of what Commissioner Tovar might be looking to do politically next? Like, is she looking to continue her political career, as she said?
She didn't say anything to me when I spoke to her about this. She is on the State Board of Education still, I believe, as an appointee of the governor. So that could be something she continues to do. But, you know, Democrats next time around will need someone to run alongside the governor for lieutenant governor. And that's a speculation on my point. I don't have any knowledge of that, but she has obviously been appointed by the governor, an ally of hers. So maybe that's a possibility.
All right. Plenty to keep our eyes on. KJZZ's Wayne Schutzke from the Politics Desk. Thanks, Wayne.
Yeah, thank you.
President-elect Donald Trump continues to make news this week with controversial appointments and proposed policies. But one of his promises, specifically to impose a 25% tariff on products from Mexico, hits close to home here in Arizona. Now Mexico says it's ready to hit back with retaliatory tariffs of its own, which would hit automakers in the U.S. particularly hard. And our next guest this morning says this move would be destabilizing for everyone. Elvia Diaz is editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, and she joins me now to talk more about it all. Good morning, Elvia. I hope you had a good holiday.
Good morning. I sure did. I hope you did as well.
Yep. All right. So you write that this move by Mexico to impose retaliatory tariffs is not just bravado. They're not just talking here. It's like survival for Mexico because so much of their economy depends on this. Tell us why.
Well, yes. As we know, Mexico is the United States' largest partner, as well as Canada. And there is an agreement, a trade agreement between the two countries. And so when the main trading partner is threatening to impose tariffs, then that would be incredibly devastating for Mexico, no question whatsoever. You know, the hardest hit here, if in fact Trump does it, would be Mexico. And then there will be the collateral damage, right? So everyone is saying that Trump is doing this just as a short-term strategy, you know, objective, because he promised during the campaign that he would stop illegal immigration and drug trafficking to the United States. And so if he can claim victory, as he apparently already did, you know, 2 or 3 days ago after he spoke with the Mexican president, then that may be the end of it. And so we would hope. But it has already caused collateral damage, and we don't know what Trump is going to do. So that's still up in the air, and we'll see.
What would the impact be specifically, Elvia, on Arizona? You say that this move by Mexico would specifically hurt Arizona among some other states.
Well, let's keep in mind that the United States manufactures a lot of its cars in Mexico, but then there are also moving parts of those automobiles that go back and forth before they ended up being an automobile, right? A car or a truck or whatever. So that will be at the top of the concerns that they will hit automakers. And already we saw when the announcement was made that Ford and General Motors, the stocks fell sharply right after the announcement. And then states like Arizona and Texas, California, and others that depend largely on a trade between Mexico and not just on automobiles. It will be on everything from avocados to fruit, to vegetables, to all sorts of fruit. So you will see those prices rise. So even if it doesn't happen, we'll begin to see those prices. And then imagine if, in fact, we can trade immediately with Mexico, that not only will we be paying more potentially, you know, for everything from cereal and all the other products that I mentioned, but also there will be a scarcity, right? Because we rely on each other. So again, Mexico, yes, will be hit hardest, but then Arizona and the states that heavily relied on Mexico trade would also suffer.
How might this potential kind of trade war affect issues, though, beyond that, like immigration, like the cartels in terms of the trade of fentanyl?
Well, when I wrote the column, the two presidents, President-elect Trump and the Mexican president, has not spoken. But since then, there has been a phone call. And interestingly, both had different understanding of what they meant in the call. So Trump came out saying, I won. You know, Mexico is going to shut down the border. They're going to stop immigration. You know, that's what I want, you know, them to do. And then the Mexican president said, well, no, not too fast. We are already largely stopping immigration in Mexico. You know, those caravans that we saw before, and I don't believe there has been any of them since 2019 or 20. So the Mexican president saying, we're already doing that and we're not going to shut the border down. We're not into that business. We actually want to build bridges between the two countries. But then, you know, on the cartels and the fentanyl, what she was saying last week and keeps saying is that as long as the United States has a huge demand for fentanyl and other drugs, it's going to be nearly impossible to stop the flow of drugs. So in fact, you know, she was suggesting in so many words, you know, deal with it, America. You know, you have the problem, you have the demand. And also you have the powerful cartels that are just incredibly difficult to control.
Right. And you make an interesting point about cartels that I wanna make here, because I think a lot of people assume that they could be stopped if we wanted to stop them, or if Mexico wanted to stop them. And Trump has threatened, like, to invade Mexico, essentially, to stop cartels from doing what they're doing. Is that possible?
Well, it is possible that Trump is going to, in fact, you know, send drones or the military and invade Mexico that way. Then, yes, of course, you know, it is possible. But to expect that Mexico will rein in the cartels, which they haven't done for decades, you know, it was in 2006 when then Mexican president decided that he was going to take on the cartels, and he did. And since then, I mean, it has been, it didn't work, essentially. And what happened is incredibly violence that has erupted in Mexico ever since. You know, violence that the United States doesn't want to see. And even this Mexican president, you know, said she was going to do like her predecessor did and essentially not take on the cartels head on, because, you know, the cartels overpower the Mexican military. And we have seen it many times. And, you know, she also mentions, and Mexicans also mentioned, that all those weapons, which is from AK-47s to AR-15s to what have you, are trafficked from the United States into Mexico. So it is nearly impossible for the Mexican president to take on the cartels by herself. Now, would she accept Donald Trump's help militarily? No, because that has also been one of the contention points between the two countries, right? The sovereignty of Mexico. So I don't know. Is Trump going to invade Mexico, as he says? You know, I don't think so, but we'll see. You never know. You never know with Trump.
All right. We will leave it there. Elvia Diaz, editorial page editor of the Arizona Republic, joining us as she does on Mondays. Elvia, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how the Gila River lost its abundance and what some in the state are doing to bring it back.
But first, crowds have flocked to Sedona for years, drawn by its red rocks, New Age spirituality, spas, and outdoor activities like hiking and biking. But over the past several years, those crowds have led some to complain about overcrowding. Sedona has had problems with housing and homelessness, and city leaders have struggled to get a handle on some of those issues as well. But our next guest says, while Sedona may be over-touristed, it's not overrated. Aaron Stroud is a freelance writer and author based in Flagstaff. In a piece for Outside Magazine, she argues despite the crowd, Sedona is still a worthwhile place to visit. I spoke with her about it earlier.
Yes, that was the idea of it, was to say, to sort of acknowledge that, yes, it's very crowded there, but it's also worth seeing.
So what to you makes it worth potentially battling the crowds?
I just think, you know, the landscape obviously is beautiful, and it's unlike anything you'll see, especially for somebody like me who came from the East Coast. There's just nothing like it anywhere else. And so I do think, you know, the Red Rock Country is just so gorgeous. It's worth seeing.
What is sort of the prevailing feeling among residents of Sedona about all of these crowds? Like, I'm, you know, you're coming down from Flagstaff, so you're close, but not in the town there. What do people who live and work there say about all these, you know, sort of these somewhat newfound crowds?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword, which I sort of get into in the piece, because the, you know, town of Sedona obviously relies a lot on tourism dollars. And so it is an important part of the economy there. I do think that, you know, it's very welcoming to visitors, and I think that they embrace visitors, but also want to be cautious of, you know, sustainability and respecting the public land. And, you know, sometimes those kinds of issues get ignored when there's so many people there.
Have you heard from people? I mean, you're obviously in sort of the hiking outdoors world. Have you heard from people who have said to you, you know, I was thinking about going to Sedona, but it's too crowded. I just don't want to do it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that, especially, you know, living in Flagstaff, you want to pick your times to go down, and we have the ability to do that, fortunately. So I don't think you'll ever catch most of us who are, you know, in the proximity to Sedona going there, just sort of the height of tourism, which to me is, you know, the spring break sort of time frame. I usually don't go down there during that time. But I'm also an early morning person. And so I think any time of year that you can get down there and get on a trail early in the morning, you're going to be okay. And you're not going to run into a lot of people.
One of the things that I found so interesting was when you would talk to friends who have sort of secret places or their favorite places to hike or to eat or something, you would ask them about them, and they would say, I'll tell you, but don't take any photos or don't publish anything. And it kind of sounded like they were maybe kidding, but also maybe not kidding.
Yeah, I would say they probably more were not kidding. I think people have like their, you know, little hidden gems that they like to visit, or where they would like to go get a beer that's maybe off the beaten track. And they don't want to share that in a publication that's reaching, you know, thousands of other people who might make those spots a little bit overcrowded.
Have you heard of that kind of thing happening where, you know, maybe a friend of yours had a favorite hiking trail or a favorite watering hole, and then like word got out and they like can't go there anymore?
I haven't yet. I do think that people around here sort of guard those secrets pretty well. So I have not heard of that happening, but I didn't also want to contribute to that in a piece that was reaching a lot of people.
Sure. So one of the other things that you write about that I thought was interesting was this idea of Sedona being sort of a place for a lot of different kinds of people. Like if you're into, you know, certain forms of spirituality, if you're into sort of a new age mentality, if you're into the outdoors, like all these types of people can find something interesting and something to do in this one place, which perhaps makes it not surprising that it is really popular with a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. I was actually I met somebody. I was really fortunate recently to be able to go over to Europe and do the Tour du Mont Blanc. And along the lines, you know, we ate dinner with lots of different people from all around the world. And I actually sat next to this one woman who She wasn't from here, but she, you know, was a big hiker, and she had visited Sedona. And what she mentioned that she loved about it as a visitor was the fact that she could bring her in-laws, who were more into, like, you know, the luxury spa vacation, but she and her husband could go out and do hikes that they weren't interested in. So there was just like a little something for everyone to enjoy. And I think a lot of people find that when they go to Sedona.
Yeah. Well, so what specifically draws you to it? Like, what do you find appealing about it?
I think my favorite part is, you know, when it's really dumping snow up here in Flagstaff, you can escape very quickly down to Sedona, where it's, you know, you could go on a run in shorts and a t-shirt while it's freezing up here. I think that's my favorite part about Sedona, is just kind of escaping the winter up here and going down there and finding a little sunshine on your face and get a little rejuvenation.
Okay, so not to give away any state secrets here, but do you have any tips for people or places to, you know, maybe people who are not super interested in fighting the crowds, where they can go and enjoy the beauty or enjoy the outdoors or any of the other stuff that one can do in Sedona and not have to, you know, wait for an hour to do it?
Yeah. I feel like any of the trails that are sort of on the outskirts of town are great. I enjoy the trails that kind of force you to climb up, and a lot of visitors will avoid those because they're a little bit more strenuous. Mm-hmm. And so I would say like Bear Mountain is great. It's strenuous going up, but you'll get rewarded by the views at the top. Mount Wilson, places like that are sort of where I tend to go, just because I like to climb up the mountains and look at everything below.
That is Erin Straub, a freelance writer and author based in Flagstaff. Erin, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The number of electric vehicles in Arizona has tripled in the last year and a half, but the number of charging stations hasn't quite kept up. And despite the state and federal government putting hundreds of millions of dollars into efforts to catch up, our next guest this morning says we haven't reached the tipping point for EVs yet. Steve Paulzine is a research professor at ASU's Ira A. Fulton School of Engineering. Before that, he was one of the top researchers for the U.S. Department of Transportation. I spoke with him more about this, and he told me even though the number of EVs on the road is going up, there's still a small percentage of all of the cars on the road.
There's still a single-digit share of the vehicles on the road, a bigger share of new sales, but a modest share of vehicles on the road. Mm-hmm. You know, a normal vehicle has about a 17-year life, so it takes a while for the fleet to turn over.
Yeah. Okay. So that makes a lot of sense. But there's been such a push, both federally and at the state level, to respond to this, to grow that industry, right? The infrastructure so that more people can buy and use EVs, especially for things like road trips, like having chargers along highways in the state, things like that. Those plans are in place, but they're a few years out. I want to talk about how these things kind of balance out. Like, you've got more people buying EVs now, a lot of the infrastructure coming, but not here yet. What comes first, I guess? Like, is this a chicken and egg kind of situation?
There's a lot of elements to it. Initially, when folks first started buying EVs, it tended to be early adopters that, you know, looked at it as wanting the new next best hot thing, or experimental. Interestingly, early on, the folks that bought them often added it as an additional vehicle to a fleet, not as a replacement for an existing vehicle. Mm. So it was, you know, a toy and an experiment, and some people used it as kind of moral signaling, their commitment to the environment, et cetera. And since then, it's started to penetrate different markets and different segments of the market. Oftentimes, the early owners were highly dependent. About 85% of the charging takes place at the home.
Right.
And they use it as a car for urban activities. And if they're taking a long road trip, they're much more likely to use a different vehicle.
Right.
But obviously now some people are wanting to be more dependent on electric vehicles and use them for long distance travel. And then the issue of charging and recharging becomes a concern for them. And all of the survey work that's been done has historically shown that that charging range and recharge capability are kind of two of the big things that have influenced, you know, the willingness to purchase electric vehicles. That, and of course, price is the other one that that were kind of the top considerations in people's mind.
Yeah. So we're kind of beyond the point of early adapters, but it seems like we are not at any kind of critical mass yet. Although
no,
the federal...
I think we're past early adapters. We're probably still highly concentrated in higher income, single family home, folks with an ability to recharge it at home and or at a workplace.
Yeah. So where is then, Steve, the tipping point? Like, when do we see electric vehicles become the norm? Or do you expect it to kind of go back before it goes forward?
Well, it's going to be a lengthy process. I was just looking at some data today. And, you know, historically, people had hoped to have 50% of new sales by 2030 as being electric vehicles. Now people are pushing that number down in the 30% range. And of course, these are all guesstimates, and they're anticipating or speculating on whether or not the new administration will remove the subsidies, the rebate subsidies, mm-hmm. or slow down the push on the electrification expansion. It is important to realize that the vast majority of electrification is either individuals or private companies. There's certainly some, you know, significant dollars that the federal government's putting in place through the states to build a charging network. But that'll be relatively modest in the total share of charging capacity that exists.
Okay. So then it sounds like it's a ways off, right?
But it's going to be a ways off. Absolutely.
And so much of this, as you're getting at there, has to do with politics, who's ending up in the White House. And the Biden administration has been very progressive in trying to put in those subsidies, boost this industry, make sure that transition happens as quickly as it can. Is the industry going to be hesitant or changing its tune based on what may happen in a potential Trump administration?
Well, they've already been changing their tune pretty dramatically over the past, oh, probably 2 years, based on market reaction. Several manufacturers have postponed and slowed their commitments to new models because the market hasn't responded as aggressively as they had hoped. There's a number of other things that are kind of occurring simultaneously. Obviously, we're seeing a lot more model choices. We're moving into the mid and lower range vehicle categories. The other thing is the prices have come down, and of course that helps as well.
Yeah, yeah. So it sounds like it's going to be a longer road than many had hoped, but it's jumped the shark. The industry is heading in this direction.
Yep, that's correct. They'll respond to the market as well, and if the market sustains itself or picks up, they'll ramp up accordingly.
I want to ask you about another thing that keeps popping up in this EV realm right now in the conversation, is that consumers seem to be becoming more skeptical that EVs are actually the answer to fixing climate change. Like, there's lots of talk about emissions in powering them and waste in the batteries, that kind of thing. Does that kind of confusion play a role here in how fast or how quickly or if at all this kind of takes over?
Not really, because the vast majority of people don't really understand the significance of electric vehicles in terms of climate. People perceive them as being very climate friendly. And in general, they are, or at least they can be. Obviously, it depends how the power that powers them is generated. Then mm-hmm. the other thing is that, you know, a lot of the energy emissions come from the heavier vehicles. And of course, those are moving to electric as well, particularly the mid-size commercial vehicles. The production of the vehicles is energy intensive, and it uses rare metals, et cetera. Most of the research says it takes about a year to a year and a half worth of use of the vehicle to kind of amortize just the difference in the energy intensiveness of the construction and disposal of the electric vehicle relative to an internal combustion engine. So they do start out on a back leg, so to speak, because they do have more carbon emissions associated with production and disposal.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. Stephen Paulzien, research professor at ASU's Ira A. Fulton School of Engineering, joining us to talk about this. Well, Steve, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for putting this into perspective. I appreciate it.
You bet.
The environment and climate change are on the agenda this week, including a major international conference and a case at one of the world's top courts dealing with climate change. With me via Skype for our weekly look at some of the key global stories in the coming days is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones in London. And Rob, what's going on here?
Yeah, there's a lot going on around the environment. We just had the COP meeting in Azerbaijan, of course. And now, starting today, we have this big conference, this UN conference on desertification, which is happening in Saudi Arabia, a country that knows a thing or two about deserts, of course. And this is really about deforestation and extensive farming that leaves land around the world degraded. And what the conference is really all about, and the ambition of the conference, is to try and restore degraded land around the world so that it is fit for kind of human use and can sustain local human communities which are threatened by this. So this is an interesting conference going on in Saudi Arabia starting today. At the same time, at the International Court of Justice, which is one of the world's top courts in the Netherlands, in The Hague, there's a very interesting debate going on. It's also running for about 2 weeks starting today. And it's looking at the legality of nation states that cause climate change. So if you're putting out lots of emissions, are you legally able to do that or aren't you? And you would think that that question has been answered. But actually, go back to the Paris, the big Paris Climate Accord of 2015, and you'll see that actually it's a bit of a gray area. And that's why the court is having to give an advisory opinion on that. And it matters because any climate justice case in the future may well cite that opinion. And that's why it's significant.
Well, that's interesting. All right, Rob, let's now go to the country of Georgia, where there have been serious protests recently. This is a country that sits on the Black Sea between Russia and Turkey. More protests expected this week. What's going on and why are people out in the streets?
Yes, so we've seen a fourth consecutive night of anti-government unrest. Some demonstrators threw fireworks at the parliament building and erected barricades, which they set ablaze. And police have been responding with water cannon and tear gas. And Georgian media report demonstrations in a number of other cities. So it looks like it's spreading. Now, we're seeing that there have been a number of public resignations. So Georgia's ambassador to the United States, for example, has stood down. And we know that there are some 240 people that have been arrested in the last few nights, and a number of people have been seriously injured as well. Now, quickly, the reason behind this is because last Thursday, the head of the Georgian Dream Party, which won Georgia's elections last month, very controversially, a lot of people think they were fraudulent, those elections, he said that they would put talks on accession to the European Union for Georgia basically on ice for 4 years. Now, that really upsets people because the pathway to European integration for Georgia is constitutional. It's written into the constitution of that country. And here is the leader of the governing party, the ruling party, which a lot of people reckon is a bit too close to the Kremlin and Russia, saying that we're not really going to talk about this. Now, he's saying this is all a bit of a lie. It's been conjured up by the opposition and that things have got a bit out of control. But really, a lot of people saying, no, this is a country that is sort of appears to be turning its back on European integration, appears to be heading towards the Russian orbit, if you like. And that's what's really brought people out onto the streets big time.
Interesting. So, Rob, we love a mystery here, and there have been a number of mystery incidents in Europe in the past few weeks and months, and now quite a discussion being had about them. What is this all about?
Well, there's quite a few things going on, and if you join the dots, you get a picture, if you like. And so the three things going on really briefly are there are several cables, undersea cables, lying on the sea floor across the Baltic Sea, that sea in northern Europe around kind of Finland, Sweden, and so on. And the allegation is that a Chinese ship that left a Russian port in November may have dropped its anchor and quite deliberately trolled that anchor along the seabed in order to capture those cables and bust them, break them. And this could have been undersea sabotage, effectively. And it wouldn't be the first time. There's been other incidents in the Baltic in recent months and years in connection with this. Now, if you connect this with these parcels that have been blowing up in courier centers around Europe, in kind of warehouses, parcels that were bound in some cases for North America And there is some element of, was this some way of probing or checking to see how well organized and how well defended, if you like, Europe is? Could a state actor have been involved in these? There are big question marks about that. And then finally, we are getting a lot of drone sightings above military installations here in the UK. And some of those are US Air Force bases or bases leased by the American Air Force. And people are concerned, again, is this some kind of probing of British and American defenses? So you put all of this together and it's making front page news in this country. And of course, the big question is the West being sort of tested or probed because it is supporting the war in Ukraine? That's the big question. So, of course, the finger points at Russia, and we'll have to see where that goes. But these are the dots, if you like.
Right. All right, so, Rob, let's end on some good news. This coming week, we'll see the official reopening of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. This, of course, comes 5 years after it was gutted by a huge fire. This seems like a pretty significant deal, not just for Paris and France, but for the rest of the world.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is the absolute heart of Paris, isn't it? It's the heart of France in many ways. And over the last 5.5 years since that huge fire that gutted the cathedral, we have seen 2,000 craftsmen working on restoring that beautiful site, what Emmanuel Macron, the leader in France, says is the soul of the nation. They've spent millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars doing this, and they've been working really hard over the last 5.5 years. Actually, Macron wanted to try and get this ready to open for the Olympics in Paris this last summer. It didn't quite work that way. But he, on Friday, took a visit to Notre Dame, had a walk around it, and it is now pristine. It's all renovated in its true kind of Gothic beauty. And this coming week, on Saturday, will be the official public reopening, and the first mass will be held there on Sunday. I should just say that people all over the world contributed to the expense of getting this renovated. And now these kind of huge timbers that make up the roof, for example, that was all burnt away in that fire. They've all been completely replaced and restored. But now they've been modernized. So there are, for example, partitions between them. There are like sprinkler systems in the event of any other fire in the future. So it's a modernized Notre Dame to some extent, as well as a resplendent renovated one.
All right, that sounds terrific. Okay, that is the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones in London. Rob, thanks as always. Really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. More than a century ago, the Gila River was lush and full of life. And the people who farmed around it, the Akumel Odom people, were thriving. But settlers moved in, laws changed, and they lost the water on the river and their livelihoods along with it. But today, life is being brought back to parts of the Gila River. And our next guest this morning was part of making that happen. David DeYoung is the director of the Pima Maricopa Irrigation Project and the author of the new book, Damming the Gila. It's the third in a 5-part series he's writing, documenting the history of the Gila River and the people who farmed it. And he told me it's been his life's work. Here's our conversation.
The river literally was the lifeblood of not only the agricultural economy, but really the cultural, political, and spiritual economy, if you will, of the Gila River Valley. It was the river that allowed a very lush environment. It's hard to imagine today because we see such a desolate part of the river. But the river itself once was a flowing river, a perennial stream lined with cottonwood trees and willow trees on that first bench or first terrace of the river.
Wow. Yeah.
And then further away, mesquite trees and lush agricultural lands.
Right. And these were kind of affluent communities, right, who were farming along the river for a very long time, right?
That is correct. There were numerous villages here in the Middle Gila Valley that were spread from roughly Florence, Arizona, all the way down to the Gila Bend area. That is all traditional lands of the Akhmaotam, and they farmed and had villages all along that stretch of the river.
Wow. And then it kind of went sideways, right? Like they became impoverished because of the fate of that river, because of settlers, because of diversion of that water, right?
Yeah, starting in the early 1860s, in particular, right after the Civil War came to a close, a fairly large group of settlers began to arrive upstream of the community, then began to take water off the river. And those initial diversions, while they weren't great, they did have an impact. That was compounded in 1872 when diversions in the upper Gila River Valley in eastern Arizona in the Safford Valley began to take large quantities of water, such that by the late 1870s, the community began to feel shortages, a reduction in acreage in cultivation or irrigation. And certainly by the mid to late 1880s, the community was starting to feel the pangs of hunger. And that was all compounded with a very serious and severe 12-year drought. They are known as the years of famine, where quite literally there were almost no crops grown because there was lack of water. Right. And this is a time where we see mass starvation among the people.
My goodness. So, I mean, this is this vast history of this river, and you have since then been documenting the centuries-long battle of these people, right, to get their water back, to regain that. And we'll talk more about where that stands today in a moment. But let me ask you first about what got you interested in this, because this is three of five books you're writing here. This is something you've dedicated your life to in a lot of ways.
Well, my interest goes back almost 50 years. I was growing up in Mesa, and my brothers lived in the town of Maricopa, which was an agricultural community at that point. And as I used to drive from Mesa down to Maricopa, it became very apparent to me that there were huge areas of land that had once been farmed here in the Gila River Indian community, but they weren't being farmed anymore. And coming from an agricultural background, my interest was picked. And I kind of made it my life's goal. I wanted to know what happened and what could I do to help correct it. And so I began, literally it's 41 years ago last month, that I began my first research on the events surrounding the Gila River and how it impacted the Akhmaotam and Peeposh people. And it all centered around upstream diversions and periods of drought and famine that caused great hardship among a people who were an extraordinary agricultural people. And I believe, based on my 41 years of research, that had the Akhmaotam not been deprived of their water resources, they would have developed an agricultural economy on par with anybody else in the territory of Arizona, later state of Arizona, simply because they were already extraordinary agriculturalists.
Wow.
And when the river dried up, or when the river diminished significantly, it had a tremendous impact.
So let's talk then, before I let you go, about what's happening today, right? Like, you also work with the Gila River Indian community through the Pima Maricopa Irrigation Project, and you have managed to start restoring the river, right? Bringing water back to this community. Tell us how you did this.
Well, I can't say that I did it. It really was the community as a whole, in literally more than 120 years of advocacy and legal action, generation upon generation upon generation, tribal elected leaders upon successive generations, who never lost sight of the fact that the Gila River, Guriacamo, Old Man River in the Otom language, was their namesake river, and it was the river upon which they depended, not just for economics, but for political, cultural, and spiritual power as well. In some cases, We rehabilitated the old San Carlos irrigation project canals, which largely were earthen lined with heavy water losses. So we lined all of those canals. We're about 90% complete now. And 4 years from now, in late 2028, we anticipate the entire project will be completed.
Wow.
So literally for me, this will have been the culmination of not only a lifetime of research, but I've been with the community 25 years, 19 years as director of the project. So what I've written about is something I live with every day. While I wasn't around to experience the effects of the theft of the Gila, for instance, I am around to see that original irrigation project and how we are today restoring that. We have one site, we call it MAR 5, where we have about a 50-acre site of the natural canopy, cottonwood, willow, mesquite, and all of the native plants that have now come back. In fact, 2 years ago, December, the latest bird count, there are over 280 bird species that now call that facility home.
Wow.
So we are quite literally bringing the river back in multiple locations.
Quite literally bringing the river back. A beautiful thing. All right, we'll leave it there. That is David DeYoung, director of the Pima Maricopa Irrigation Project and author of the new book, Damming the Gila. David, thank you so much for coming on to talk about your work in the book. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Lauren. Thank you for the opportunity.
And that'll do it for this Monday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. Not sure if there's any, like, Thanksgiving feast photos up there, Lauren. I've not checked it recently.
Not
any,
from mine, but
no,
you know what?
Pumpkin pie or
I think we should all donate one of whatever we liked best.
Okay, fair enough.
Up there.
All right. Well, that is at KJZZ The Show. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org, and you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.